Jenny Worthington, and I will be introducing you to people and organizations around the world who are working for animal welfare. We're being called to participate in making the world a better place, and the people I will be talking with are on the front lines of critical work that we need to know about so that we can support them. I hope you enjoy, and thanks for listening.
Hello, and welcome back to Hello Animal Talks. I'm Jenny Worthington. I'm bringing you another wonderful guest who is working in Latin America and working for the International Fund for Animal Welfare. He's the regional director for Latin America and the Caribbean for that organization. And he's going to tell us about the work he's doing for animal welfare, which is what I want to highlight for you. His name is Joaquin de la Torre Ponce, and I'd like to welcome you, Joaquin. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Jenny, for the invitation, and I'm very happy to be part of the group of people and organizations that you're interviewing. So thank you.
Yes, absolutely. I appreciate you taking the time. Give us a little background on how you got involved with wildlife and the International Fund for Animal Welfare.
Well, it goes all back to my childhood, of course. I was a typical child. I was born in Mexico City. A lot of people call it a concrete jungle, you know, because it's full of buildings and concrete, not a lot of green spaces. But nevertheless, since I was a little boy, I grew a lot of interest and passion for living creatures like animals, plants, whatever. And I was a typical child that would come home with little creatures in my pockets and show them to my mom. And my mom would be like, take that out of the house, you know? And so since I was a little kid, I had the interest. Then when I started getting more serious about it and growing and deciding how I studied, I was about to study my major, right? So I was like, I really want to work on these issues, but I don't know what to do. So first I thought about being a veterinarian, but then I am the typical guy who, when I see blood, I faint. So I was, no, maybe that's not a good idea. Then I was thinking, okay, what do I enjoy the most? And it's funny because my grandma, she used to give me every birthday or every time there was an excuse to give me a present, she would give me a tape, a VHS tape, because that's what we used it back then. A VHS tape of David Attenborough's documentaries. I was fascinated by, David Attenborough, David Attenborough, I don't need to say anymore. Of course that when I was at this point of my life of deciding what to do, I said, well, I really enjoy watching documentaries and I think it's a great tool for showing knowledge and you know, create this movement of consciousness about protecting the environment and protecting our planet's biodiversity. But then, then I said, okay, I will study communications, right? So I studied communications, but it was really funny because when I started taking the subject of production, of filming and TV production and all that, I said, no way, that's crazy. It's a type of work that I don't think I'm going to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. But I was already there, and it's not that you can just change from major just because of that. I mean, some people can do it, but I was in a situation with a scholarship and other things. I was, you know, I had to continue. I had to keep my grades really, really high to keep my scholarship and all that. So I said, okay, I'll just continue and I can do communications and work on NGOs, on non-governmental organizations, right? So that was my plan since I was in my early 20s or even younger, perhaps. And then when I got graduated, one of the first things that I did was to go to Canada. I went as an international volunteer for WWF, and I stayed there for almost 1 year doing, you know, what volunteers do, from folding papers and stuffing envelopes for people to helping on outreach events and other stuff. And it was mainly also to practice my English because it was quite rusty. And I think it still is, but at least I do my best to
No, it's good.
So I was there, and it was a really good experience to know how these organizations work, it was a glance, not really to know, but you know, it's a good glance, a good overview of the type of work you can do as an NGO and working with an NGO. So when I came back to Mexico, it was so funny because, well, within the different, you know, scope of NGOs that are all over, of course that there are NGOs that you feel more, I don't know the word in English, but that you feel you will fit better in some NGOs than others because of the way they work, because the type of campaigns they do, the style of their communication or things like that. So there were a few NGOs that I was really clear for. It was really clear for me that I didn't want to work for them or engage with them because of the style. Because I don't think they're doing a good job, because I think every NGO with their different styles, they cover a function. You know, they have a role and they have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And regardless if you agree or not agree with their style, they do their part.
Right.
And that part is important. So, but IFO was one of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. It was one of the organizations that I really wanted to work with, because IFO has this unique combination of, it's a kind of hybrid organization. And I'm going to talk about how IFO was back then and how it has been evolved a little bit from the years, because I've been working for IFO for, I think, 17 years now. When I started working for IFO, it was a hybrid because we were both an organization that was funding projects, but also an organization that owns projects. And that still remains.
Yeah. Okay, so what you said, funding and what else?
And owning.
Owning.
Projects, right?
Right.
So okay. we were both funding, for example, a marine turtle project or a whale watching initiative.
Right.
But at the same time, we also had our own projects, you know.
Right.
So that's a powerful combination that we still remain, that we still have, and that's something that makes IFO quite unique.
Yeah.
But not only that, what makes IFO even more unique is precisely what you mentioned as your objective, the animal welfare emphasis. Because, for example, I like WWF, I like the work they do, but it's all about conservation and it's all about population of animals and wildlife. But the difference, a clear difference, for example, in styles will be that for IFO, the individual animal matters for conservation. Even that we're talking about just one jaguar,
right,
or an elephant or whatever, for our philosophy and values, that individual animal matters for conservation. So we will do our best to either preserve or either implement whatever it's needed to provide animal welfare to such individual animal. A conservation organization approach will be like, okay, let's value where we invest more, in the individual or in the whole population. So again, both approaches, in my opinion, are right. Mm-hmm. It's a different approach.
Right.
And by targeting the population, maybe you will secure, yeah, the population and whatever. But also the individual for us will be securing the population, right? Especially if you're talking about an endangered animal where individuals are quite important, right? So anyway, so the point is that when I started working for IFO, I started doing communications, and it was for me, I could say that one of the best experiences that I have had in my life, because first of all, because I got the job without having all the requirements to get the job.
Wow.
It was so funny because I was just recently graduated, right? I was quite young. And the Latin American, we used to have a Latin American office based in Mexico City back then. And they were looking for a communications coordinator for Latin America and the Caribbean. And the requirements for that job was, it was like a senior level position, right? Like a person with a lot of experience, with already publications and post-grad studies and a bunch of other. I mean, because there is a misconception of the world of NGOs. For many people, they think that it's just passionate people loving animal people doing work. No, there's a huge competition, and people that work on NGOs are highly with high academic levels. So it's difficult, you know, to get a job in a serious and a serious NGO, because it's as hard as getting to the private sector. So
right.
So I was there, you know, looking at the requirements, and I was like, I won't get this one. But nevertheless, I'm quite stubborn. And somehow I started, you know, knocking the door, and I started, you know, knocking the door and knocking the door and sending, you know, emails to the person who was in the front desk at the IFO office back then, to the point that I got a meeting with the person who used to be the Latin American and Caribbean director back then. And she was very kind to receive me. We had an interview, and I was very honest with her. I told her, you know I don't have all these credentials that you are required for this, but I want to do a career on this. It's my passion, is what I want to do, is what I want to where I want to invest all my energy, my resources. I am offering you, back then I was still living with my parents. I was young. And in Mexican culture, it's not that bad to still have 20, 21 and still live with your parents. It's completely normal. So I was still with my parents. And so I talked to her, you know, I still live with my parents. The only living creature that depends on me is my dog. So I can give myself the privilege of working for you for free.
Right.
But what I want you is to try me, to test me. Because what it's really difficult is to have that opportunity to show people if you can or cannot do a job. I told her, if I notice that I cannot do the job, that I cannot cover it, I will be the first one to recognize them, to say, you know, thank you so much for the opportunity, but certainly this is for a higher level senior position.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think she liked my proposal. She told me we will call you. And I think I waited like for 3 weeks, and those were the longest weeks in my life, because I was like, I'm not getting any news, you know. So finally, I got a phone call from the front desk lady who was like, "Well, your stubbornness is giving you results. So present on Monday to start your trial." So I went there on Monday. And the Latin American director told me, okay, I like your enthusiasm. Certainly you don't have the credentials. Certainly you don't have neither the age, neither the academic that we're requesting, nor anything. But I like your enthusiasm, and you're going to be on trial for 3 months.
Wow.
So I said, yeah, go for it. And we're going to pay you a symbolic. It's not going to be for free, you know, because it's not that we're going to exploit you. So, but you're going to be on trial for 3 months. And I said, okay, go for it. So I started my trial. And then after 3 months, I got the official welcome to the team. And that's 17 years now.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah. So, and it's been an amazing journey for me, because I have been able to, well, you know, some people say, there's a saying, at least in Spanish, that it's that you want to leave your grain of sand, you know, for the cause. But I'm always like, I don't want to leave a grain. I want to leave a brick, you know, or if not a brick, like a whole wall.
Right.
Or a whole plotter, you know, for me, it's I don't want to just leave the grain.
Right.
It's too small for me. So, and it's been a quite a journey. I have had many, many amazing moments in my life working for IFO, and even experiences like in the field, even that my role is, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a veterinarian, so even that I'm not a hands-on guy that will deploy to do some rescuing or whatever. Well, because I was doing comms, I had the chance to sometimes go to document some activities like the seal hunt in Canada, for example. It was amazing, you know, for imagine a Mexican walking in the frozen ocean, right? And listening to the noises of the seals, the noise of the ice cracking below. Like, that was an amazing experience. And knowing that I brought that campaign to Mexico, basically, it was an unknown issue in Mexico. And we even got the Senate and the Chamber of Deputies to do an official claim to about this issue. Like, it was really, really positive. I also was able to go to the Gulf of California, where now sadly there's in the news about the vaquita. Vaquita, it's a porpoise. It's a marine mammal. It's the smallest porpoise in the world, and it's an endemic species. Sadly, it seems that there are only 10 left, literally 10. And that's mainly because it's a bad combination of living in the wrong place for vaquita, because vaquita shares the space with totuaba. Totuaba is a fish which bladder is one of the most valuable items in the Asian markets as an aphrodisiac and as for medicinal purposes. So it's called the cocaine of the ocean. So that gives you an idea of the value in the black market. So sadly, because of the illegal fishing of totuaba, vaquita is literally about to get extinct. IFO was able to work with other NGOs to donate a vessel to investigate vaquita and to do some research. And we provided acoustic equipment, underwater acoustic equipment. So I was able to listen to them. I was able to watch a vaquita, you know, in the ocean, which, I mean, you can count like people with your hands of how many people have seen a vaquita alive. I mean, it's such an elusive animal and such a small animal.
Yeah.
And so few of them. So a lot of experiences. You know, we just recently released a jaguar that we were part of as well of a coalition of government authorities and the Mexican Alliance for the Conservation of Jaguars. There was a jaguar that was hit by a car. The authorities took the jaguar and they brought the jaguar to the zoological park that is in the border, in the city that it's the border with Belize, just as a geographic reference. And then after 100 days of rehabilitation, because fortunately there were no major injuries, we did x-rays, we did all the testing, of course, we were able to release the jaguar in a biosphere reserve. And the Mexican Alliance for the Conservation of Jaguar, they installed a satellite collar that fortunately the jaguar was able to took it off after a few months of the release. So now we know nothing about the jaguar, but I mean, he survived for a few months. So
right.
For a few months, that means that he's thriving, and that was a magical experience, you know, too, because we used the IFO animal rescue vehicle to transport the jaguar because we needed to control the temperature at the beginning, because when it's sedated, you need to be very careful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been amazing experiences from that to, you know, marine turtles, whales, you name it. I feel very fortunate for having a job that I really love. But not only that I really love, that I know that what I'm doing, it's for good, it's for my daughters, you know. I have two daughters. So I believe that, or I hope at least, that what I'm doing is going to leave them a better planet, you know, or hopefully not as bad as we're leaving it, because humanity is really doing a terrible, terrible job.
Well, I mean, I just think it's amazing. I mean, I would love to do what you're doing, to have those opportunities to go to all those different places and be part of all those different projects. What would you say is your main role? Is it to educate? Because are you still in communications? Is that sort of your main thing, where you're making the people aware of what is happening with these different animal groups?
I wear a lot of different hats in the organization. The Latin American and Caribbean team is quite small. The Latin American office that we used to have in Mexico City was closed in 2008 when we had this major financial crisis worldwide. So the situation was difficult for everyone.
Uh-huh.
So we had to close the office. Since then, the Latin American team has been of only two people. So it's just me and one veterinarian.
Wow.
The veterinarian, she's mostly in charge of all the field work we do in the state of Quintana Roo in Mexico, where we used to have first a companion animal program in Cozumel and Playa del Carmen. And then now we finish those programs in a really successful way with the organizations that we were supporting. Now they are super strong organizations within the community and the work they do, and they were able to grow thanks to the support we provide to them, which is the goal, being a fund an international fund for animal welfare.
Right.
And now we have an amazing project that is contributing to the conservation of jaguars and marine turtles that is called Casitas Azules, Little Blue Houses. And this project is a coexistence project because we found that there was a threat that jaguars were facing, which was not a small threat, at least not in the state where we were operating and working, which was the predation of dogs by jaguars. And, you know, when communities expand in all this habitat that it's at the end, it belongs to the wildlife, not to us, right?
Right.
When we expand, then jaguars face different threats. First of all, there's fragmentation of the habitat and connectivity. If you suddenly put a road and a settlement, and then it was a corridor for jaguars, and that stopped. That's, you know, you killed that corridor. You basically killed that interactions and genetic, you know, sharing. So,
right.
So what happens is that suddenly that brings a bunch of, it's a cascade of issues. And one is, for example, or could be the reduction of natural prey. It could be also just the bringing of other prey that might be easier to hunt, less energy. You know, if you're a predator and you want to, you look for the injured animal, you look for the small, for the babies, you know, you look for the easy catch.
Right.
So, of course, if I'm a jaguar and you give me the opportunity to choose between chasing a deer or a wild pig, I will choose a dog by far. I mean, it's much easier to just, you know, grab a dog when the dog is sleeping.
Right.
Or he's not sleeping. I mean, it's a dog.
Yeah.
It's not going to kick me like a deer or not going to bite like a wild pig. Right. So, but that's not, I mean, but the problem for us as a conservation organization was not the fact that jaguars were eating those. You could say, well, good for the jaguars. They're getting some food. Right. But the problem was that there was a risk of first of all, the risk of the community feeling fear for jaguars coming closer to the community and maybe grabbing a baby, a human baby or whatever, which, by the way, it's very important to mention that at least in Mexico, we do not have any single report in all the history of Mexico of a jaguar attacking a human.
Wow.
Jaguars in Mexico are smaller than the jaguars in South America. Maybe that's the reason. We don't know. But there are no jaguar attacks on humans in Mexico. So, but still, regular people, they don't know that. They don't know, and they don't want to risk it.
Right.
So the retaliatory killing, it's a very common threat for jaguars because of that. But not only that, for us, which is perhaps one of the most important reasons why we had to do an intervention, it's because distemper, canine distemper, which is a very common disease on dogs, can be transferred to jaguars and ocelots and pumas and other felines from the wildlife. So it's very unfortunate, but most of these isolated or communities that tend to settle in the outskirts of the cities or in isolated, you know, fragments of the jungle, is usually people with disadvantaged, social speaking, economically speaking. So, of course, that it's quite unlikely for them to have their companion animals, particularly dogs, vaccinated, dewormed, etc., right? So the risk of transferring distemper to, let's imagine that the jaguar that is coming to hunt on these dogs, it's a female with cubs. If you bring that disease to the cubs, you might be wiping out a full population of jaguars,
right? because
of one sick dog, as simple as that.
Wow.
So it's a real threat, a serious real threat. So we said we need to do something because this is happening. It's you will be surprised on the amount of complaints or records that we gather about conflicts between jaguars and companion animals. In fact, because we're part of a state wildlife management committee. So 49% of all the reports of jaguar conflicts with communities, 49% are linked to dogs.
Wow.
So it's almost half of all you know, all the scope of issues you have with conflicts with human wildlife conflict, almost half of them is related to dogs. So it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
Right.
We were surprised that even that this was not necessarily news or new news, sort of saying. The typical approach that the jaguar conservation community or scientist community was taking was the right idea, because it's correct for them to say, well, there should not be dogs here.
Yeah.
And they are right. We should not have dogs or cats here because it's the jungle or because of whatever. But in the real world, it will be naive to believe that these people is not going to have dogs.
Right.
Especially because dogs, they have a function in these communities. They are guarding dogs, hunting dogs, or companion dogs. But they have a function. So if a jaguar or anyone disappear a dog, they will bring another one or bring another, or they will just reproduce and reproduce and reproduce, right? So that's why we created this really beautiful project that is called La Casitas Azules. We do the interventions with the communities where we bring like a one health, one welfare approach to the communities. We try to promote this because we know that when you elevate the welfare and health of your animals, you also elevate the human welfare and health of the humans. So when we do these interventions, we try to do a whole wellness campaign with the animals.
Right.
We do both vaccination, which is key. It's key to vaccinate because of this risk. We vaccinate, we deworm, but we also sterilize. We do spay and neuter of the animals because we also want the population to be controlled.
Uh-huh.
And we even encourage people that if they want to get another dog, just to call us, we can, you know, they can adopt a dog from us, or we can get them a dog or do whatever to avoid them to fall into this reproduction thing that happens all the time.
Right.
We do that, but at the same time, we also do an assessment of, okay, what's needed, because we're not talking just about dogs. Jaguars also predate chicken, dogs, whatever animal they have. And in these communities, it's very common for them to have, again, what we call the backyard animals. So it's poultry, pigs, dogs, turkeys, you know.
Yeah.
So, for example, in this, there's a Mayan community that we do the intervention that they were having the visit of one or two jaguars. Back then, we didn't have camera traps to monitor. Now we have camera traps. But back then, we didn't have. So what we did was chicken coops that were jaguar-proof, that were predator-proof. Because the way they were keeping their chickens, first of all, they are used to let them roam free during the day. And some didn't put them like in an enclosure.
Yeah.
And the ones who put them, the enclosure was, well, there is, it's a little wire fence, but it's like very thin, very easy for, I mean, for a jaguar, it's a piece of cake to just break and just grab whatever it's in the menu. Because it's like that. I mean, for a jaguar, it's like suddenly the buffet is open, you know?
Yeah.
What is going to be today? A dog, a chicken, you know, like yeah, a cat. We don't have a record of a cat, but I mean, at the end, it's an open buffet, you know? So.
Yeah.
So we did these really cool chicken, predator-proof chicken coops with the community. And what we do is that we provide them with the materials, but they are the ones who build them, because we do a community engagement project. It's for them. It's their project. It's not our project. It's not our animals, you know? So it's for them. So they really engage. They collaborate. They organize. And the reason why it's called Casitas Azules is because we were also providing shelter for dogs. At the end, one of the reasons why jaguars are predating on dogs is because if you have a dog that is not properly fed, the chances of that dog to roam during the evenings and night looking for food are higher, which is the same time that the jaguar is going to be roaming looking for food. If the dog doesn't have proper shelter, then of course it's more exposed. And if it's not vaccinated, we know what happens. So the idea of the house is it's a symbol. It's truly just a symbolic thing for telling the community, this family or this household, they have engaged in this project and they are on, you know, and promoting animal welfare and promoting responsible care of their community animals, not only dogs, all the animals. The logic is that the weather here is, I mean, dogs don't need a shelter like a, you know, like a little house because it's really warm sometimes. Uh-huh. Nevertheless, they tend to like, you know, just getting inside some little cave or right. some little house. So we provide a house. The jaguar, the way jaguars attack is they bite, they don't bite the neck as other felines. They bite the head, the skull.
Skull, yeah.
The skull, yeah. Uh-huh. So if a dog is sleeping in a house, then the jaguar will need to go and attack from the front. So it gives more chances to the dog to bark, defend, and maybe the jaguar will think about it. Uh-huh. Of course, if a jaguar wants to grab a dog with or without the blue house, it's going to be the end for the dog. I mean, we need to be honest. So we're honest with the community. But at least we're giving them this symbol of for them. And the reality is that a lot of people, turns out that in a lot of these communities, when their own dog is vaccinated, deworm, spay and neuter, so by spay and neuter, it's not peeing everywhere, and it's not, you know, fighting with other dogs or looking for trouble or trying to go out to get a girlfriend or a boyfriend, you know. Turns out that when they see this change in the behavior, they open the house to the animal, and then the dog just get in the house.
Oh, interesting.
It elevates the welfare, you know, of those animals.
Wow. So
they don't live anymore outside, most of them.
Yeah.
They live more close to the family. So it has a lot of benefits.
Yeah.
And right now, for example, and it depends, like in each community is different. I give you this example of a Mayan community that it's in the middle of the state. Uh-huh. We're also working in another community that it's a fisherman community in Mahahual, where jaguars are predating a bunch of dogs, but they're also predating the marine turtle. It's a natural prey of jaguars.
Oh, interesting.
And but turns out that dogs also predate on marine turtles, both the eggs and adults. When a flock of dogs comes together and they are roaming free in the beach.
Yeah.
Marine turtle going out or getting back to the ocean because she was nesting.
Yeah.
They bite the turtle and they might kill the turtle or leave the turtle quite injured. And all marine turtles are endangered. So, endangered species. So that is a big risk for marine turtles. In this community, we are serving the two species. We're working on the conservation of the two species. First of all, together with the community, they decided that instead of a blue house, because they don't need a blue house, they actually need to keep the dogs contained during the evening and some night. So they literally built pens. Uh-huh. With strong wire to keep the dogs like completely secure. And also so that we can keep the turtles in peace doing their business, doing the natural behavior. So now I'm very pleased to share with you that we have, now that we have camera traps, we have seen that the jaguars are not attacking the dogs anymore because they find the dogs like in this fence and it's like, I cannot do anything. And they are predating on marine turtles. So we have the evidence of jaguars going to predate on the natural prey. That's normal. That's, you know, that's what we want to look for. I mean, I feel bad for the turtle because it's also an endangered species, but so is the jaguars. I mean, it's part of the natural world.
Part of the natural, that. Michael. Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you say camera traps, or these are cameras you've set up to capture the movement of different animals, what's happening when nobody's there to actually see it.
Yeah, like for example, I mean, it's camera traps are a common tool that is used in conservation. They're not cheap. And sadly, in many places in the world, Mexico is not the exception. People tend to steal them.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but here's a jaguar that we just recently saw in one of our camera traps. There you go.
Wow.
And this guy, which was predating on dogs, now there's evidence of this male predating on a marine turtle.
Wow.
So that local partner there, he's trying to, he knows that the turtle that he's predating on, because jaguars, they usually come back to eat and they go, they come back, eat, and they go. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to take pictures of the jaguar when he comes back. He hasn't been lucky, but the camera trap captured that image. So
wow,
so it's just a tool. It's at the end, our goal and the emphasis is the community, working with the community. But of course, these visual tools are very important for us because then we can even show to the community, hey, this is the guy, you know, this
right.
who is messing with your dogs or your pigs or your chickens or whatever.
Yeah.
And when people see the animal, even in person, because we have the testimony of a lot of community members telling us, I was just sitting here and I just saw the jaguar, you know, walking in front of me, and I was frozen, yeah, looking at the jaguar like, wow. And you know what's beautiful? That we have not received any single negative perception of the jaguar. All the comments we get about the jaguars is that it's such a majestic animal, such powerful animal, such a magical animal, blah, blah, blah. So people, they don't want to harm them. They don't want to do any bad to the jaguars. So of course that they welcome this support. They welcome this, yeah, to try to keep the jaguar safe. So
wow, that's incredible. Yeah, I think that IFAL does such an amazing job with incorporating the needs of the community and the animals to make it sustainable, the solutions, you know, to make them worthwhile for the communities to take part in. Otherwise, they would be so temporary. So I think it's just incredible. I think that's such a key component, is to create the ability to coexist.
Yeah, I think that what you're saying is it's very important. If we want a project to become sustainable and to survive and not just be the typical temporary support that will solve in the short term an issue, but then it will just fade away and come back again, or you can even strengthen the problem by doing it. You need to invest a lot of time sources for that. And I think it makes sometimes for even for donors and supporters, they want to see like immediate results. And I do a lot of work on international policy, for example. So any change of policy, you need to invest at least between an average between 5 to 8 years.
Yeah.
To see some results, you know. So it's not just like, oh, I'm going to do a campaign and everything's going to change. No,
right.
It's literally, yeah, you need to invest. And it's the same with any community engagement project. At the end, if you do not engage community, your chances of having a successful project are really low if you don't do it. But communities change as well. They evolve. One of your goals is to do some behavior change in that community. And a behavior change in a community will take 5 years, 6 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
So you need to be patient.
Yeah.
And you need to be humble on understanding that changes will be a long journey, but it will, if you keep doing it and if you don't quit,
yes,
and then you will start looking at results. And now, for example, we have been working on this issue since 2016 now.
Yeah, so that's a long time.
So yeah. And of course, about this, of course, with all the background of all the years we have been in the state working with the authorities on other issues,
right,
and being part of these different animal welfare committees, wildlife committees, etc. So,
well, it sounds like the community's already seeing the benefits as well as the animal.
No, for sure. I mean, it depends again on what I can tell you about the projects we have done. For example, Playa del Carmen, there is a community that it's called Invasores, which means invaders. And it's called Invaders because it's basically a settlement of people which they are taking advantage of a legal gap.
A loophole?
A loophole, exactly.
Loophole. Yeah.
Because they are settled below high-tension electric towers.
Okay.
Which is considered in Mexico federal territory.
Oh.
But because this is all over the country.
Right.
They are in federal territory, but surrounded by municipal territory and state territory. So the authority that needs to take them out will be the federal authority, which is in Mexico City, quite far away.
Wow.
So municipal authority, they don't have the authority to kick them. Right. So they take advantage of that loophole. to settle there. And when we first visited that community, and one of the reasons why we visited that community was because they were having issues of jaguars coming to grab the dogs. When we went there for the first time, and I think this was in 2012, something like that, 12, 13. If you ask me how can I describe the scene, it was like a movie set, like a Mad Max movie set. It was smoke in a bunch of places because people, they tend to burn the trash. Mm-hmm. We don't have management, so they burn it. They just burn. So it was, so the smell, the smoke, like everywhere. And you will see like dogs crossing, like it's just one road. It's a dirt road. There are some where the cars cannot even go in because it's so rocky and...
Right.
So it's there. It's a dirt road, and with houses, you know, all in the side, and you will see a lot of dogs in really bad shape, in really skinny, full of mange, full of skin diseases. It was like a Dante's, you know, like Dante's Hell.
Yeah.
Movie set. It was amazing. And then after doing this community intervention and working with the community and bringing veterinary services and improving the way and starting to control a little bit of the population, etc., I can tell you that today, if you go to that same place, and there were many other chains. Of course, the government, they started giving them some, because of political reasons and getting votes, you know, that they will go to these communities and they will tell them, oh, I'm going to put you some electricity so that you can have light in the night. Because that was a really, really dangerous neighborhood because, well, people who live there, they have questionable backgrounds.
Right.
And, of course, during the night, it's been there. It's like being in, you know, you don't want to be there. Simply don't want to be there at night because there's no light, there's no cell phones. Signals, so you're there, you're
alone.
There's no one, you can scream whatever you want.
Yeah.
So now they have electricity and now it's more humane to be there. But nevertheless, it's still the same community. And after years of being there and years of working with them, now they're not only grateful with us, and they, for example, my colleague who is the one who goes in a regular basis, now it's more expanded. First of all, it was in an almost daily basis, of course, because of it's the normal process of a project is for give the you know, empower the community so they can embrace this and then go on so that you can leave. Otherwise, it's an endless story, right?
Right.
But now if you go to this place, I can tell you that, in my opinion, is one of the places with the highest levels of animal welfare in Playa del Carmen.
Wow.
You can still see roaming dogs free, but healthy dogs, you know, with good shapes.
Yeah.
The skin is healthy, you know. And if you consider, you know, from a natural behavior point of view and the five freedoms and the five domains and all that, then you will see that they pretty much cover everything, you know. So the levels of animal welfare in that community, from being one of the worst scenarios that I saw in my life, it became one of the most beautiful changes because this is another example of how people started to just bring their dogs inside a house, even if it's a humble house, even that the floor is the same floor that is the floor outside, because there's the same dirt floor. Mm-hmm. It's the same floor. There's no, they don't have any different differences. You know, outside is the same as inside. There's only a roof.
Yeah.
Some sticks and a hammock, you know, that's a house in some cases. Others may have more sophisticated houses, but pretty much is that. So, but that has been how many years now? It's like 7-8 years of working with them.
Yeah.
It's you need to invest and you need to keep, because in my opinion and our philosophy, as well as at least from my perspective as a manager and the same for my colleague, she's the veterinarian who is in charge, Dr. Erika Flores. It would be quite unfair to do a community intervention and bring all these benefits and things to the community and then get out.
Right.
It's fair.
Yeah.
It's unfair, and it's a commitment that they didn't ask for at the
right.
end. They were just living their lives the way they do it, and because the way the perception of animal welfare is different for many people and many cultures and idiosyncrasies and economical status, you know.
Definitely.
Maybe for a lady in Beverly Hills, animal welfare means having a poodle with fancy clothes and sleeping in a pillow with whatever, right? But that's not animal welfare for this community. For this community, animal welfare is the dog being with no illness, you know, interacting in a healthy way with a community and with the humans and the other animals around it.
Yeah.
That's welfare. At the end, at the end, that's animal welfare as well. So,
right. So
yeah. So we adapt, we do the adaptive management approach depending on the community. Like the example of the way the fishermen community, how they want to deal with the animals and compared to the Mayan community in the middle of the jungle, right? So yeah, that because what we want to do is to fulfill the community's needs so that our intervention is meaningful, first of all, useful, and for them to embrace it and keep it and continue it.
Right. That's incredible. I love it. The South America, Latin America, they have such a diverse, huge wildlife population. And I know there's a lot of illegal trade that goes on with animal parts and turning them into pets illegally. And do you all deal with that?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the main, we have, at IFO, we have different programs, which we have like two pillars. One is conservation, mm-hmm. and there is animal rescue. And on animal rescue, it's both wildlife and domestic animals or companion animals. So animal rescue and conservation. And then we have different programs. One of our programs is wildlife crime. So we have marine conservation, we have community engagement, international policy, we have disaster response and risk reduction, we have wildlife rescue, and we have wildlife crime. And in wildlife crime, we try to cover all topics related to illegal wildlife trade. And that applies not only to pets, but also shark fins, ivory, you know, more like massive consumption items like those ones. So yeah, and within the scope we do, there's a lot of cross program. I, for example, I do a lot of international policy work to strengthen the wildlife crime work we're doing. Like for example, CITES, which is the convention on international trade of endangered species of flora and fauna. Then that's the only, I don't know how to say that in Spanish, but that is the only entity that is allowed to actually request a country or even punish a country for not fulfilling protection to specific species which are in danger. So CITES, which is the acronym CITES, they divide the species in appendixes. So it's appendix 3, 2, and 1. So appendix 1 are all the species which are on the risk of which international trade, only international trade, will put that species in the risk of extinction. And of course, we're talking about species which are already at the risk of extinction or quite endangered. Jaguars are, for example, on appendix 1.
Okay.
And then appendix 2 are species which they have a level of concern in terms of conservation, and they need to be managed in a way in which such international commerce or trade is not bringing or contributing to that species extinction or decline of populations.
Okay.
For example, sharks. A lot of the shark species are on appendix 2, which means that countries need to regulate the fishing activities so that the sharks that they are fishing or hunting, I'm not sure which word to use because for me it's kind of hunting, but it's fishing anyway. So that what they're doing is not contributing or in detriment of the species, which sadly it's very complicated for a country to regulate that. But it's the only entity, CITES, that can do that. So we work really strong with countries and with CITES management authorities. Every country has a CITES management authority and a scientific authority. So that, A, we both promote the inclusion of more species in the appendixes, which we think are in the need for being considered in such appendixes, or we also help on the implementation of the countries, on the implementation of CITES, on how to do all the regulations and how to apply the management so that the international trade they're doing is not affecting on jaguars. And now one of the areas in which IFOE is working really, really hard is on cybercrime. All the illegal trade of species on internet. It's not a new topic for IFO. We started working on that. Our first report was actually in 2004. It was a small investigation that was done in the UK. Our office in the UK did a small research on the illegal trade of wildlife on the internet. And imagine internet in 2004. It was not a big deal as it is today.
Right now,
for the last 5 years at least, in all these big conventions and conferences that I have been, it has been stated in all of them that cybercrime is one of the major threats that needs to be addressed in a much more aggressive way, because it's globalization and these new tools and social media that can connect you to anyone all over the world, and that you can literally start doing trading activities with someone in Asia or Africa or whatever, meaning whatever. I mean, it's truly a big issue that it goes beyond borders, it goes beyond legislations, because it's. You know, it's all over the world.
So right
now we're also working really hard on that. IFO has been a key player on promoting the strengthening of internal policies of these websites that sell products. We are part of a coalition that is called the Coalition to End Wildlife Cybercrimes. This coalition is formed by WWF, Traffic, and IFO. And we have achieved a lot of successes, mainly in Asia. And in this coalition, there are 38, as far as I remember, we have 38 private sector companies with names like Microsoft, Google, Tencent. Tencent, it's a monster. Facebook, you know, I mean, it's 38 companies.
So sorry to interrupt, but these companies, what is their role? Are they sort of looking out for suspicious activities on their sites?
That's exactly. Yeah. So the role is for this coalition, what it's looking for, it's we approach them and we tell them, you know, this is the snapshot. This is what's going on.
Yeah.
And the reality is that you are a key player. I mean, traffickers, bad people is using your platform, your technology to do a crime, right?
Right.
And of course, they are not criminals, and of course, they don't want that to happen.
Right.
So they work to improve their first of all, they improve their policies, but they also improve their algorithms, search engine and algorithms, so that it's even more difficult for a trafficker to sell or promote anything on their platforms. But of course, it's paramount for us as users that every time we look at a suspicious item in one of these platforms, to denounce it, to you know, to inside the platform say, you know, report this is a suspicious ad. Right. So every time I look at something, I report it, because the only way these systems, they learn by these reports. So if you don't report, the system doesn't learn. So you need to feed knowledge to the system, right? Uh-huh. And for example, to give you an idea, we in 2019, I was invited to to present in the first Jaguar Illegal Trade Conference that was held in Bolivia. So I presented about cybercrime, and I presented about the illegal trade of Jaguar and Jaguar parts on internet. And back then, we have an office in China. IFO has an office in China. So my colleagues from China, they were really nice on doing an investigation, because I cannot search in Mexico. I cannot, you know, get into the platforms they use in China. So they jumped in and they did this investigation in 2019. They found a lot of advertisements in different websites. They found from Jaguar fans to Jaguar bones to heads, a lot of items. But we started feeding, you know, and because of we are part of this coalition, and because I have to recognize that these online platforms from Asia, Baidu is one of them, Tencent, all of them, they have done a really good job on fighting this. Just to give you an example, like an eBay, for example, as well. I mean, eBay, they deleted and blocked, they blocked 165,000 advertisements after becoming part of this coalition because of this.
Oh my gosh.
They blocked that and they eliminate those advertisements from 2017 to 2019. So we're talking about 165,000.
Yeah. Wow.
They just wipe them out. That's, we don't want this here. Boom, away. Baidu, which is a monster in Asia, they in also in the same time frame, and I'm using this time frame because that's when we did some case studies,
mm-hmm.
2018 to 2019, Baidu, which again, it's a monster, they also eliminated 270,000 announcements, advertisements, 270,000. But not only that, they were able to dismantle 44 closed groups. So when you work with cybercrime issues, you need to understand that there is the open web.
Mm-hmm.
You Google it, it's the result.
Right.
Then you have a closed net, which is, for example, a Facebook group or whatever needs an invitation to be part or a password to get in, you know. So Baidu was able to dismantle 44 groups and they blocked 94 users. And then Tencent, Tencent is the company that owns WeChat. And WeChat, it's also like perhaps the most popular social media platform they use in China. They have their own initiative that is called Tencent for the Planet. They have also blocked more than, I think, 5,800 accounts, user accounts. They blocked them and they delete those accounts because they were doing illegal activities and selling illegal wildlife. So that gives you an idea of the power of this, making these coalitions and working with them. And of course, we try to do trainings and workshops, and we engage with Interpol and with other agencies. And I'm very happy to share with you that I just recently was invited to also present in a webinar from UNODC, the United Nations Drugs and Crime Organization, and for the South American Wildlife Enforcement Network Point of Contact. So I asked my colleagues from China, and I said, hey, guys, I'm going to present about cybercrime again. And I was, you know, I'm curious. I'm wondering if there has been any change. So they did another investigation now in 2021. Actually, right now in April, we just did it.
Wow.
And they did the exact same search with the exact same keywords. To give you an idea how tricky to do this is, it's because a smuggler or a trafficker, they are also very clever people and they will try to on this algorithm. So, of course, they're not going to put Jaguar fan on sale.
Yeah.
That's going to trigger immediately, then it's going to be deleted.
Yeah.
So what do they do is that they use a big American cat tooth, right? So big American cat tooth. So that gives you, okay, so it's a puma or it's a jaguar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or they, you know, they start playing with the words American fang, fangs of American tiger or American tiger. So they start playing with words, right? So it's very complex. So again, the system needs to learn all this. Mm-hmm. But now it's more difficult. You know, what smugglers are doing in these same platforms is that they're just putting no words. They just put the pictures. So now our office in China, they are working with these platforms with some artificial intelligence tools. So this tool, it scans all the images on the app. And because of the images that we feed them, again, as users, to tell them this is illegal, they will detect all these images and they will pop up in the system to detect them. Otherwise, we will not be able to imagine. We're talking about millions and millions and millions of advertisements that are posted every, perhaps every minute.
Yeah.
We're talking about, it will be impossible to track all of them down, but thanks to artificial intelligence, it's getting easier. The good news that I wanted to share with you is that they did the same research, they did the same investigation, and they found nothing.
Oh, wow.
So there are many ways to give an interpretation about this. The reality is that, well, first of all, the algorithms are working.
Uh-huh.
We're doing with the coalition. This is a clear result that this is working. Just to give you an idea, and I'm trying to find my presentation to give you the numbers because we found nothing literally. It was the same.
And you don't think it's because the traders have changed their algorithms as well?
No, I mean, the algorithm is what the platform has, you know.
Okay.
And it's so what I think is happening is that the goal and the objective of this coalition is to make the traffickers almost impossible to do illegal trading on these platforms. What I think is happening is that A, they are moving to other platforms that are not part of this coalition, which bring them to much smaller platforms with a much smaller range of customers,
right,
which is good news. Or B, they are going to the dark web, which, if going to other platform narrows the market, going to the dark web even narrows it even more because I by no means would like to go into the dark web and risk to be my computer and everything being hacked, you know? So if they are moving to the dark web, that's also good news.
Yeah.
What is going on is that we're just making this activity much harder to the truck. And that's the objective. So whatever the outcome, it's a good outcome.
Yes.
And the good news is that, again, that they found nothing. I mean, they just found, I have my presentation here. Just to give you an idea, the artificial intelligence tool that search on the images, they found 7,120 images of wild animals. From those 7,120, just 7%, which is 516, were products from big cats, from tigers, jaguars, or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And from those 516, only 56 were actually related to illegal products of felines.
Wow.
From those 56, zero images were clearly identified as jaguars. It could be jaguar, tiger. I mean, they are illegal because it's the announced, the advertisement is there. But then there's a lot of these products, which is fake fangs or fake teeth.
Oh.
With fakes.
Yeah.
That's super common as well,
right,
in the market.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to identify without any other information if what you're looking is fake or real, or even to do a species identification. One of the reasons why we know that the jaguar fang is so popular or became so popular in the Asian markets is because if you look at jaguar fang and a tiger fang, they look pretty much the same. So
okay, say that again. If you do what?
If you look at jaguar fang and a jaguar
fang, okay,
they look pretty much the same.
Between a jaguar and what?
A tiger.
A tiger.
Mm-hmm. So it might be a replacement of tire fans. We don't know.
Yeah. Still bad, though.
Of course.
Yeah, we don't want either of those on the market.
So we're doing our part. And IFO has been focusing a lot on that. We, of course, we need resources. Of course, if we want to engage in a campaign to reduce the illegal trade of exotic pets, we need money. We need to the commitment of authorities. We need the commitment of the academia, the research institutes. But we do it, of course. If there is an opportunity, we also take the opportunity, and we are also applying to every funding opportunity that comes out to do this type of work.
So, right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, so important. Well, I think it's amazing what you do. Do you have people... Okay, so you have your veterinarian and you guys are the only IFAW people in the whole of Mexico?
The whole Latin America.
All Latin America?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Like, how do you get anything?
Well, that's what I told you, that I wear many hats. Sometimes I'm doing home, sometimes I'm doing policy, sometimes I'm doing disaster response. Sometimes I'm doing, you know, I do everything.
Yeah.
I love it, so it's fine. Sometimes I'm wearing a suit. I'm going to all these high-level meetings, and sometimes I need to just jump into the mud to rescue or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
We need to be versatile.
Yeah.
There's also one other person that she is based in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
We also consider her part of the Latin American team, of course. She's a Mexican that lives in the U.S. And she became part of the team because we have a project that is called Operation Jaguar. It's a project that we have in collaboration with another organization that is called Earth League International and IUCN Netherlands. And she is the project manager of that project, which is funded... it's a funded project by the Dutch Lottery, but she's also, we're very lucky to also have her supporting on other, mainly wildlife crime issues. We can say we are three, two based in Mexico and one in the U.S. in Washington.
Well, it's a big job and I'm glad you're doing it. I'm really excited to get people aware of what's going on there and what the work that you're doing. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, so I'm going to let you go, but I'd love to keep in touch and maybe talk to you again in a while and see how things are coming along. I'm going to put IFAW's information at the end of the video so people can donate and help out with any projects that you have going on there. Gosh, I just think it's amazing.
My pleasure, and anytime, whatever you need from our side, if we can, anything we can do to promote a better world. And as you, well, what says?
Jaguar.
Yeah. It says in Spanish, but it's kind of our motto. It says, animals and people thriving together. That's what it says there.
Oh, so, yeah.
And people thriving together. And that's what we want to do. So whatever we can do to achieve that animals and people thrive together, well, then we can count... Come with us for that.
I think that is the key. That's the key going forward. I think that's a great motto and something that we should all support. So thank you so much
for the invitation. Thank you so much. And my pleasure. Anytime, Jenny.
It was great talking to you.
Likewise.
All right, Joaquin. Thank you so much. Continue good luck with everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hello Animal Talks, hosted by me, Jenny Worthington, production by Stacy Spencer of Going Graphic, sound engineered by Jimmy Richards of Bay Central Media, and music written and performed by Jake Shepard.